Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us today. Two-time Grammy-winning songwriter and music producer Tina Clark was born in 1953 in a rural Mississippi town with a legacy of slavery, racial injustice, and Klan violence still a part of everyday life. Tina herself led a privileged life. Her father was one of the richest men in the state. But as a child, her parents' marriage dissolved into a swamp of alcohol, rampant infidelity, and some straight-out racism. Adding to the turmoil, Tina understood from a very young age that she was different from her three older sisters, all of whom had been beauty queens and majorettes. In her new memoir, Southern Discomfort, Tina tells the story of growing up in the Deep South in a fraught family where life at times was deeply lonely and chaotic. Southern Discomfort is published by Touchstone, and Tina Clark is in studio. Nice to see you.
Oh, great to see you.
So, Waynesboro, Mississippi. What Correct. Is Waynesboro, Mississippi like?
Small. Hasn't changed a lot, mm-hmm. except I would say it's lost the main street to a certain big box. And it's still very familiar to me, but I like going home, but there's not much there.
When you were a little kid, did you understand that you were of privilege, that your dad was a rich man?
Yes.
How did that explain itself to you?
I realized that when we had the only swimming pool in town. And I think as a kid, that was like, what? You know?
Yeah.
But also, my dad changed cars, kind of like most people change clothes. And he, you know, had three or four cars at a time, and he would get new ones like every 4 to 6 months.
Hmm.
When I went to college, people thought that my dad owned a car dealership.
Because there were so many cars right. coming in and out.
Right.
Now, how did he make his money?
He was a self-made man, started out with nothing, worked his way up in the sawmill logging business at first. First worked for my grandfather, then he ended up buying a truck and then buying his the sawmill. And then he had a gas station, and because he had a gas station, he decided he should own the oil distribution. So then he owned the oil distribution, and then he decided, well, if I own the oil distribution, I should go out and drill the wells and get the oil myself. And that's where he made his money. So my dad was always like, okay, this is not enough. I need to own a bigger part of this. But his wealth came through the oil business.
So he was an ambitious person.
Very ambitious, and a great business guy, but that's all he really had a two-track mind, money and women.
Not family and children.
My dad, you know, as my mother used to say, when I would pine over the fact that why couldn't daddy tell me he loved me? Why did he not hug me? She'd say, well, your daddy loves you as much as he's capable of. He's a complicated man.
Hmm.
And so it's not that he did not show us. Well, I learned later, I guess, that he couldn't say I love you, and he wasn't warm and fuzzy. But like my mother said, he liked to wrap his love in $100 bills. So he thought by buying you things and doing those kind of things that was the key.
The way you describe your mother, you said she was gorgeous, 6 feet of a wild kind of beauty, flawless olive skin, a thick mane of jet black hair, and eyes the color of dark chocolate. When did you realize your parents' relationship wasn't good?
As early as I can remember. I guess probably 3 or 4 when I first started remembering things. My sisters were all much older than I was, and they were, you know, they're all in their late 70s now. Mm-hmm. And so they had a different life. They had a different childhood than I did. As my mother would say, my entire life, I was a save the marriage baby that didn't save the marriage. So that kind of starts you out at zero, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because babies make things so much easier in a marriage.
Right. Exactly. And I think that you know, when they were growing, and I think they tried one more time because they wanted to have a boy. And this was like 11 years later. Mm-hmm. And then I think they kind of just threw in the towel at that point and started going at it.
Well, your mom had her own deep internal life and her own ambitions and her own dreams. There's a passage here that you write about your mom and where she came from. And then we'll talk about her a little bit on the other side. If you could start with, I suspect.
Okay. I suspect every big family has a black sheep or two for whatever reason. Mama was the black sheep of the Atkinson clan. She dreamed of making something of her life besides a wife and a mother. Most of all, she had fantasies of becoming a famous songwriter and performing with a big band in New Orleans, ideas that her mother and sisters ridiculed to the end. Maybe thinking of herself as the black sheep was easier for her than admitting the truth. Her own mother seemed to despise her, treating her viciously when she wasn't ignoring her altogether. Another family rumor had it that Mama and perhaps her younger sister were not actually Big Mama's daughters. Roy Clifton had a reputation for sleeping with a lot of women, including his own maids. It's possible Mama and Jean were products of an affair, and Big Mama had agreed, albeit resentfully, to raise them as her own. Whatever the real reasons for her cruelty, Vanidra Atkinson relentlessly taunted and punished my mother, often beating her with a belt after her sisters blamed her for something she didn't do. Things didn't go much better for Mama when she fell in love with Lamar Clark.
We're talking to Tina Clark about her memoir, Southern Discomfort. When did you realize that your family's story, and we'll talk a little bit more about that story, would make a good book? And why did you feel like you wanted to write this all down? Because a lot of this is really, really personal.
Yes, it is. That was hard. And I won't go through the whole story, but basically about 20 years ago when I was producing an artist for Blue Note in Philly, Rochelle Farrell, I was in Philly, we were writing, and I was in a hotel that night, and my dad and I had gotten into it about something that he was trying to convince me that happened, that did not happen, that I knew did happen. Right. He was famous for gaslighting, and we all kind of in this country know about a little bit about gaslighting now. And so when I got off the phone, I just decided, you know, I've got to write this stuff down. I've got to record it, not for anybody, just me. Because so I don't feel like I'm crazy sometimes. Well, I turned on my little recorder and I started talking, and eight hours later and a few tapes later, I stopped. I took it back to LA where I was living. I had someone to take down the dictation. And from there, I showed my mom and I said, Geffen and Universal want to do a film of this. I did not pitch it to anybody. So a friend had read it, took it to him, and what do you think? She said, she cried, and she said, I want you to do this. It will be very cathartic, but would you please wait till I pass?
Interesting.
And I said, absolutely. So I put it away. 15 years later, nothing. You know, I mean, my mom passed away about 15 years after that, and still did not have it in my radar. Debbie Allen and I were flying to Atlanta from L.A., and we've been working together a long time. And I was telling her one of these stories, and she was just cracking up. And she was like, girl, you have got to write this down. And this is a movie. So then that led me to Norman Lear, my friend and mentor. And I said to Norman, who would be a great scriptwriter? And Norman said, I love this, but this has to be a book first. And I said, but I didn't plan on writing a book. He said, go write the book and come back. So I wrote the book.
Wow. So is the film going to happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just, you know, obviously the book is newly out. Mm-hmm. And it's just went out to my agent, just sent it out a few weeks ago.
Well, we'll knock wood for you on that.
Yeah,
one.
Whatever. That was the journey of this. It wasn't like I sat down and said, oh, I'm going to write a book. But I have to tell you, it's been an incredible journey doing this, a lot of soul searching. I stopped several times through the process of about 3 years. And if my daughter really, really encouraged me, and every time I would be afraid to finish, she would say, "Mom, where's your courage?" Hmm. And she's 32, and I did it. And you know what? I have no regrets, because I felt like it was so timely as far as where we are today and how it reflects what was going on in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s. And I started to say especially the South, but it's a little bit of everywhere.
Yeah.
But especially in Mississippi.
Well, the book deals with domestic abuse. It deals with hardcore Klan racism. All kinds of words are used about your mom tried to kill your dad at one point. Do you think, you know, I'm thinking when I read your book, I was thinking about several books we've read that have been very popular recently. Sarah Smarsh's book about Heartland. And hers is the opposite, about growing up very poor in the Midwest and the South. And Hillbilly Elegy, the idea that there's something about this part of the country that other parts of the country don't understand. What do you hope people learn about your life and this part of the country at this time that might be useful now to know?
Well, I think it's about, for me, I would love for the takeaway to be, and so far it seems that it has, to be about forgiveness and grace and redemption. And as you know, you've read the book, at the end, there's quite a twist and a surprise. And a lot of times that I think, as far as the domestic abuse part of things, I hope it tells a story of to not settle in relationships. Do not settle because of money. Do not settle because of power or status that maybe that marriage brings you or that relationship brings you, because I have seen it happen too many times, is that if you don't live your truth, it will live it for you, and it may not be pretty. And as we see that happen all the time, whether it's in drug abuse or alcoholism or obesity or whatever it may be, to settle in a skin that doesn't belong to you. So I hope that. I also hope that it brings conversation to the issue that is there, and that is racism. And when I did two book signings in Mississippi, and really all over the South, but I was a little nervous at first, but it was incredible. And it was like people were so hungry for conversation. And it's, you know, I just couldn't take any more the pretending that it wasn't like what I write about, and also that it's not racist. If they do admit that there's racism, but that ended a long time ago. That's not the case. And so I think now the hopeful thing is that you do have a lot more people that are fighting the resistance on that and saying we do not tolerate it than you did back then. But I think it still takes begs a really hard look, and as we see in just what's happening in the name calling in politics, and especially down there right now. So that, and then, you know, my process of coming out and just, you know, I never had a choice. I never thought twice about it, but I did have three debutante sisters and majorettes and drum majors. And, you know, I didn't want to be a majorette. I wanted to marry one.
So. Your mom's response to it was I actually thought very sweet. She was, it was a very maternal response, actually. Can you share what that was?
Yeah, I was the end of my senior year in college, and I had an apartment, and she felt like there was something in between us, because my mother and I were very close. Even though she was an alcoholic, I knew how to deal with, you know, there was never a minute that I ever doubted my mother loving me so much. And so she was at my apartment visiting, and she said, "There's something between us. There's something wrong." I said, "No, there's not." So then she asked me, she said, I will not take that answer tell me what it is. And I said, Mom, it's nothing. And she goes, oh my God, you're pregnant. And I was like, no. And I kind of laughed, and she goes, oh my God, you're in love with a married man. And I was like, no. And she goes, well, what could be worse than that? Those are the two things that, and I said, well, I'm not saying anything's worse, but Mom, I'm gay. And she just looked at me and she goes, you are? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she was sitting in a rocking chair, I'll never forget. And she said, she just had this look of shock on her face, and I didn't know what she was going to do. And she said, baby, will you come over and come sit in my lap? Now, you got to realize I was grown. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I sat in her lap, and she put her arms around me, and she started sobbing. And she said, I'm not sobbing because I'm upset. I'm sobbing because of the pain that you and discrimination you will experience.
Throughout the book, even though things are difficult, you know, you understand that there's love in this family, and that's part of the glue of the whole thing. There's love between you and your parents and your siblings and the woman who works for you, even though she's a black woman. You know, it's that strange close but far situation that happens in so many Southern homes. And forgive me if I don't have the timeline right, did your mom get to see your musical success? Because she really wanted to be a musician. That was what she really, really wanted.
Yes. She was my balcony person.
Yeah.
She would be sitting in the audience. Every club I was playing when I was on the road for so mm-hmm. many years before I moved to L.A. and, you know, had the success I had, she would come to every club. She'd show up. She came to my musical when it opened in Philadelphia. She wanted to, I called her every day before I went to work and on my way back, whatever, in the studio. She wanted to know everything I was doing, what I was working on. She wanted me to sing her, let me hear the new song. Can you sing it to me before? Mm-hmm. And those moments were just precious, you know. So I would say, well, Mom, I would say, what do you think, you know? And I'd ask her, what do you think about this? Do you think this chorus is blah, 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 or this verse is?
She must have loved that.
Oh, she loved it. Because I, you know, her songs she wrote in the 40s and 50s, and I thought her songs were great then. They were mm-hmm. big band songs, and they were really good.
Well, it was a pleasure to have you, Tina Clark. Oh. The name of the book is Southern Discomfort. We could keep talking because there's a lot of stories. A lot of stories. Good luck on the rest of the book tour.
Thank
we'll keep
you.
Our fingers crossed for the film version of
yes,
Southern Discomfort.
Thank you.
All will be back after a quick break with the director and the star of a new play about the tumultuous life of comedian Lenny Bruce. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. One of the most enduring names in comedy is Lenny Bruce. He died in 1966 from a drug overdose, but his legacy in comedy is as vibrant as our culture still battles with issues of free speech and the power of words. A show called I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce ran for 110 performances in L.A., was an L.A. Times Critics' Choice, and has now come here to New York off-Broadway at The Cutting Room. That's at 44 East 32nd Street. By the way, and it's up until December 30th. Happy to welcome Ronnie Marmo, who stars as Lenny Bruce, and director Joe Mantegna to All of It. Welcome, guys.
Thank you, Allison.
Thanks very much.
So, Ronnie, this isn't the first time you've been living with Lenny Bruce. You've been living with Lenny Bruce as an actor and a writer for a long time. How did you first get involved and decide that this was a person that you wanted to tell his story?
Well, a great comic named Charlie Brill came to me about, I guess, 12, 13 years ago, and said, I have this one-man show, and you remind me of Lenny. Do you know who Lenny was? And I said, well, I know, but I know what everyone else knows. So he handed me the script. I read it. I got nervous because I thought, well, Lenny's friends might come. So after a couple of years of him, you know, trying to talk me into it, I finally did this play. And it was a wonderful show, and I ran for 6 months. But we weren't able to do the bits in the show. He didn't have the license to do the bits, the playwright, and all that. So I felt like once I fell in love with Lenny and really understood who he was and the parallels he and I shared, I asked the playwright for his blessing, and I went off to write my own. And I wrote the rest of the story that I felt like at some point I was kind of disrespecting Lenny because I wasn't telling all of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. What was missing?
Well, first of all, his routines and the material, but also a lot of you know, his the rise and fall of Lenny Bruce. I mean, his hardship with addiction, his relationships. I felt like the other play was a wonderful introduction for me. But I felt like it stopped there, and what I wanted to do was tell the whole man, you know, his whole story.
You wanted to get in it.
Yeah, I wanted to tell the story of this amazing man who had a lot of flaws, and you know, as you know, in this country, we seem to be attracted to those flaws. So I just wanted to tell the whole story, and so everyone got a full idea rather than just the foul-mouthed comic people think they know, and I wanted to make him human.
And how did you get rights to the bits?
Well, Kitty Bruce and I met during that process, and it's Lenny's daughter, and she's one of my best friends on the planet now. And for the last 10 years, we've been talking and spending a lot of time together, and eventually she said, I trust you, and I want you to do it, and you know, she gave me the best compliment. She said, you know, this is the best portrayal of my father I've ever seen, and this is the first thing that I am completely behind. And so, what else do I need? There's the review, right? So,
Joe, you and Ronnie have known each other for a while. When did you come into the project?
Well, Ronnie approached me, you know, a few years ago, actually. I knew he had this connection with Lenny and wanting to, you know, do this play. And when so we had already worked together on a film, and I had directed a piece at his theater company. When he came to me with the script and said, look, I'd like you to look at this, And when you have time, you're the guy I would like to direct me in it. And I said, well, let's see what you got. And I just basically went into an empty theater, and I had him do the play for me. And once I saw what he had, once I saw the material, I already knew what an accomplished actor he was. But when I saw him bring this material to life, I knew that I wanted to do it. And I said, look, I think it needs work. I think we want to change a few things structurally, move some things around, add something, whatever it is, the things that a director's supposed to do. So I said, but, you know, if you're willing to wait until my hiatus time from my day job, which is what I've been doing the last 12 years, he said,
it's Criminal Minds for anybody.
Exactly. So when that hiatus time came, we did it, and I'm so very glad that we did. I mean, I just feel he is accomplished everything he hoped to set out to do when writing this play and performing it.
So Joe, as a director, and since you're also an actor, what is your process when you have to talk to Ronnie, because Ronnie's both the star of the show and he wrote the thing?
Well, Ronnie, you know, it's very comfortable. I mean, Ronnie and I are pretty joined at the hip. I mean, we're he's from New York, I'm from Chicago, but we're both, nobody confuses us with being like farmers from Iowa or something. I mean, we're two very urban kind of guys and similar kind of backgrounds in many ways. So I think we talk a lot in shorthand, and he has no ego that way, in the sense of like, you know, if we'll talk about something and I'll give him my opinion, and if we come to an agreement on it, there's never been any sort of like conflict about, hey, look, you know, I wrote this thing, I'm in love with every word, you can't change this, you can't change that. He was very, I think he was smart enough to realize that sometimes you need that outside eye to come in when you're also writing and performing the same thing. And I think the collaboration, I certainly couldn't be happier with it, and I think Ronnie hopefully feels the same way. And so I think we accomplished what we set out to do by doing this thing, you know, together.
Ronnie, what was a change that came from Joe or came from your collaboration that made the show better?
Well, first of all, let me say, it's easier to work with a director when you admire them so much and you go, I want to be great for this guy. So there was only one or two times I was like, Joe, I love that, please, you know. it was great. But I have to say really quick, today's Joe's birthday.
Oh.
It's Joe's birthday. I'm sorry, Joe. I don't mean to embarrass you.
All right.
Anyway, you're very handsome. All right. So you're welcome, pal. But Joe, what he did, he took it the final 20 yards. Like I did some of the courtroom scenes early in the play. He's like, no, let's push them to the end. Let's bring the family in. Let's fall in love with Lenny. There's a famous N-word bit that Lenny does, which is about taking the power out of the words. For 5 years on the page, that was my opening line of the play. And Joe goes, we can't do that. Are
yeah, I'm
crazy?
With you, Joe.
No, it was stupid. But I needed Joe. So he goes, because then it's just shock for shock value. And let's fall in love with Lenny a little bit and get to know the man and go, oh, I see. And still not everybody sees, by the way. That's a very big topic.
That's a difficult one.
No, it is. And I'm scared every night. You have to see, Allison. I'm freaking out before I do it. In fact, I'm probably more scared than Lenny was, because we're in a very different time right now. But I do it because it's like I can't not do Lenny Bruce. It's like I'm either going to do it or not do it. Mm-hmm. And so, but I do it with love and with hopefully with grace and hopefully communicate what Lenny was trying to say, you know.
We're speaking with Ronnie Marmo as well as Joe Mantegna. He directed and Ronnie stars in the play I'm Not a Comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. So the first scene is not a pretty one. It's at the, you know, Lenny Bruce is destitute. He's dying. He's overdosed. Why did you decide to make that the first scene?
Well, actually, it was Joe's idea. What happened was, is I always ended the play how Lenny ended his life. But Joe said, why don't we bookend it? Why don't we start lights up and you're dead naked on the toilet? And then the play doesn't let up from there. You know, like no one expects that image. Mm-hmm. And then you slowly come back to life. And that whole first scene, he's coming back. And then by the time he gets to the bit we just discussed, he's in his prime. And it was Joe's idea. And so I think it's really cool. And I think it like really sets the tone for the piece. And I thought, you know, let's let the audience know we're not messing around. This is what happened. Mm-hmm. Here we are, and let's do this, you know?
Joe, do you want to dive in on that? Why that's the first scene?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just, look, I started my theatrical career doing the play Hair in 1969. And at that time, there, you know, everybody would talk about, oh, the nude scene, the nude right. scene, the nude scene. Like, this was such a big thing. You know, Tom O'Horgan was wise enough to take something that was fairly an innocuous moment in the play, actually. It was a powerful moment. But all people could think about was, oh, my God, there's nudity in this thing. Da-da-da-da. So, I mean, so in a way, jump cut now 50 years ahead. And I, when I see that this is how this guy died, I thought, you know what? It's shocking in a whole other kind of way, not in a kind of you know, perverse kind of, oh, let's go see if we're going to go see naked bodies on stage here kind of way, but now it's like, but it still does have that same element of almost shock value of like, this is the way, this was the demise of this guy, and I want to put this in your face the very second as the lights come up in the theater. This is what you're confronted with, and you don't know what the hell's going on, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, now the play begins.
There's a lot of uncomfortable giggles when the
yeah,
lights come
exactly.
up. They go,
oh. But I wanted that. I mean, so now we tell the circle. We start the circle at the end, and that leads us to the beginning and brings us back to the end. And it's the truth. This is what happened. And so I think it's fitting that as shocking as this guy was, the impact he made on in show business, it seemed totally relevant for me that. And Ronnie jumped in. He was right on board. I said, hey, kid, you good with, you know, being naked on stage right as soon as the lights come
I
on?
Wasn't good with it. Joe's like, get over it. Get over it. Show your ass. Nobody cares.
I got over it. I told him. I said, look, I was naked on stage for a year and a half every night in the air, so, I mean, you can get over it.
He's like, I got one
no,
on
no,
you,
No, seriously.
I,
well,
got one.
I just found out the other day that in the new venue we're doing it, that I guess I'm not turning around far enough to put on my shorts. And so if you're sitting house right, the mystery's over. I had no idea.
We're going to charge extra money for those seats.
Joe, I didn't tell you, but they told me, the mystery's over. So I said, wow, I thought I was trying to be cool about it, but I guess I'm not. Yeah,
charge extra $10 for those seats.
So what does the title mean to you, Ronnie? I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce.
It means exactly who he was. I mean, this guy would get up on stage. I mean, he was one of the first comics to get on stage and pull out the newspaper, sit quiet for 5 minutes, and then suddenly talk about, you know, how Jackie Kennedy in that famous picture was trying to haul ass to save herself as opposed to going to get help. And he would discuss that. Mm-hmm. He held the mirror up to society. I mean, you know, I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce. And there were many nights he apologized, said, I'm sorry I wasn't funny tonight. He didn't go for the joke. And he did early in his career, and then one day he realized that wasn't his voice. So it tells the whole story. It's not a comedy, it's a tragedy, this play. There's some laughs, and we go on a ride and have fun. But if people, there have been a few people who I think came with an expectation to laugh all night, mm-hmm. and that's not what's happening. You will, you know, hopefully you'll laugh. But it's kind of like that car accident that you rubberneck and you just can't help yourself and you stare at it for 85 minutes. And so I think that's who Lenny was. He wasn't a comedian. He, you know, he affected poetry, the law books, you know, music, comedy, obviously Pryor and Carlin, those guys. You know, he paved the way for everybody. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, to me, it sums the whole thing up, you know.
Joe, as a director, Ronnie alluded to it, that there's a part of the show where the N-word is going. You as a director, tell us a little bit about the conversations the two of you had about how are we going to do this and how are we going to do this in a way that can be successful? Because
well,
if it's not successful,
No, I understand. But I got to say, I feel very strongly about that whole thing about censorship of words. I mean, I just do. Because my feeling is, I understand the significance of that and how, it, how harmful that is. But on the other hand, there's this whole thing of, like, where do we draw the line then? Because there's a lot of harmful words that were used for a lot of different people. I mean, you know, being Italian-American myself, there was always, you know, the dago, wop, greaseball. And so, I mean, do we start to draw a line and say, okay, now here's one word that we have to take and put it aside. And I think this is what Lenny would have said. You're giving power to this word by now saying, oh, do not utter this word, because once you utter this word, you know, the apocalypse comes. So does dago become the D word? Does greaseball become the G word? Does spick become the S word? Does kike become the K word? And yet I understand, no, the N word has a much stronger, more powerful significance because of what went down with, you know, African Americans in this country. But on the other hand, and I think when people see the bit, hopefully they get it, that that's the point Lenny is making, that by singling that word out and saying, now look, you can say any other word you want in the world, but don't say that word. You're now giving it a mystical, magical power. Whereas I think when you see it, its context in our play, it basically tells you, look, it was a horrible word, it was a horrible thing, but now it's time, let's diffuse this, let's diffuse all the hatred, let's diffuse all of this stuff, and let's not just, you know, wrap our heads around a word and say this word is the problem that once we just label it, because to me then it's just as offensive to run down the street, maybe look at somebody and say, hey, you N word, what is that about? I mean, is that's okay? But if you actually add the rest of the vowels and consonants, now you've crossed the line. To me, that seems a little crazy, and yet, you know, and believe me, I understand all that, but that kind of censorship, I think that's the point Lenny was making, and you know, I think it's up, you know, people are going to have their own feelings about it, but that's the way I feel.
Allison, can I just add that Joe was very sensitive and gentle when we rehearsed this, because we just had to make sure. I mean, look, the other night I had two young African-American girls walk out on me. And then the next night I had three people stand up and applaud and cheer and say, that's right, exactly. So I'm never going to please everyone. Mm-hmm. Again, if I was doing this play and I was writing it, I wouldn't include that. But Lenny did, and I have to try to stand behind that, whether I actually believe it or not. You know, that's what's interesting about playing a man. You know, it's like, what are my beliefs? What are his?
Because those were his beliefs, whether they're right or wrong.
And they were simply his beliefs. And so it's a scary thing, because, like, who am I to decide what that is? But if I'm going to tell his story, I have to tell his story. And if people open their heart, I think most people, I'd say 90%, kind of go on the ride and see it, even if they disagree, but they don't, like, get up and leave.
Yeah,
but
I think even of the book, because I did the play years ago of Huckleberry Finn. And I think that was the whole point, even in Huckleberry Finn, that Mark Twain was trying to make. I mean, he was the actual opposite of a racist. He was trying to prove the point that, you know, he was trying to take that power away from the racists by that. And so that's why I'm saying, I think, and I think Ronnie is right, if we're going to show that, we have to show it all, you know what I mean? And also because it was the opposite of being done mean-spirited. Lenny was championing, you know, African-Americans by doing this bit. And if somebody doesn't get it, then I think that their mind's just a little bit closed, and they're just not understanding that the effect of this bit is to do exactly the opposite of being, you know, derogatory or being offensive. It's to show, you know, how misused and how, you know, how jammed up we're getting about everything in this world, you know. And we just have to kind of respect each other, you know, regardless of words. And, you know, I mean, go back to when you were a little kid, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones and words will never hurt me. I know it sounds naive and infantile in some ways, but yet there's some truth to that. We got to get past that and get to more important matters.
I disagree personally, but I understand why it's in the play.
All right.
Well, Dick Gregory's son and I had a long debate after the show, and he agreed. You know, and that's what's funny. It's right. It's Dick Gregory's son, and that's what's great. That's what theater is. Let's just talk. Let's
Makes
have
conversation.
You know, that's the thing. That's the point of theater, right? Let's discuss. Again, I have to repeat. I'm not saying I agree or disagree.
No,
I'm just saying I'm doing the guy. You
it's
know,
it's all good. Ron, you said in an interview that this show it's like 80 minutes of therapy every night
for me.
For you personally,
not for anybody else. It's 80 minutes of a car accident.
Why is that? What is
well, because the truth is like I explore, you know, the deepest corners of my heart in this show. I don't really like watching acting. When people watch acting, that's a problem, right? Nobody wants to see acting. So I just turn myself completely over to the performance and to the words and to Lenny, and I don't hopefully you don't catch any acting because my heart doesn't know that I'm acting. And so I explore all of it, every bit of my family life, my love, just all of it. I explore all of it. So you know, you follow. So
I do. That's the name of the show.
Oh, hey! I didn't put that together. See, man, you're right on it. She's like, that's my show. Of course, I know. So that's why. It's just I just kind of lay it all on the line, you know.
The name of the show is I'm Not a Comedian. I am Lenny Bruce. It is off-Broadway at The Cutting Room, which is 44 East 32nd Street. Joe Mantegna and Ronnie Marmo, thank you so much for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Allison.
We'll be back after a quick break. Today on Fresh Air, listen back to an interview with Stan Lee, who died at age 95. He was Marvel Comics chief editor and co-creator of Spider-Man, Black Panther, and The Incredible Hulk. Plus, Karina Longworth talks about her new book, Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. That's today at 2 on 93.9 FM. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Stan Lee died yesterday at the age of 95. An American icon, he was the chief writer and editor of Marvel Comics, the co-creator of Spider-Man, the X-Men, many more. He was also a consummate New Yorker, and so were most of the characters, many of them anyway, that came to life at Marvel. Mayor Bill de Blasio tweeted, "Stan Lee created some of the most incredible and enduring characters of our time, and he chose New York City as the place to tell their stories. On behalf of his hometown, I want to express our deepest condolences to his family and loved ones." And Governor Cuomo tweeted that Stan Lee was a true New Yorker whose limitless imagination helped create some of the most beloved characters in popular culture and made NYC just as big of a character. Excelsior, Mr. Lee, and condolences to many of his fans on behalf of the New York family. Abraham Reisman? Thank you. I thought I got
like
that wrong.
Like Reese's Pieces.
Abraham Reisman, my apologies, is a staff writer at New York Magazine and Vulture. And in 2016, he wrote a profile of Stan Lee's legacy. It's called Stan Lee's Universe. Abraham, welcome to All of It. Also, people, we want to hear from you, our listeners. Did you grow up with Marvel Comics? How'd they affect your life? Did you give you a new sense of New York City? Or if you just want to weigh in on Stan Lee the man, give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, all things Stan Lee. Abraham, what is Stan Lee's origin story? Where did he grow up?
Stan Lee was a New Yorker. He went to DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx, along with a number of other cultural luminaries. It's a bizarrely fertile ground at DeWitt Clinton. He was a child of the Depression. His father was chronically unemployed while he was growing up, and that instilled in him this belief that a proper man, always has a job and is always working. And true to form, he was working up until almost the very end. He was still cranking out projects of, you know, varying levels of quality or fame, but he was still out there in the hustle right into his twilight years. But yeah, started out in New York and remained in New York for a long time until he moved out to Hollywood.
How did his stories reflect him being a New Yorker?
Well, for one thing, they were largely set in New York, as you said, which was remarkable at the time because, you know, the 1960s when he started the Marvel Revolution, because comic book superheroes tended to hang out in, you know, Metropolis, Gotham, right. Central City, Keystone City, all these made up burgs. And Stan was a big fan of the Big Apple, and he thought, well, why the heck not just have them hang out here? And he used real brand names. He used cultural references. And this all seems so obvious to us now, but no one had really tried that in superhero comics prior to then. And it really led to a level of familiarity between reader and creator that stoked a lot of fandom.
Tell us a little bit about his career trajectory. How did he end up in the world of comic books?
He had a bunch of sort of random factotum jobs. In fact, somewhat ironically, he pre-wrote obituaries for a wire service and, you know, wrote publicity copy. But he had a relative who owned, was the publisher of this publishing company called Timely. Timely later became Marvel, but at the time was just known as Timely. And Stan went to work for him. This guy's name was Martin Goodman. In 1940, he became a gopher there, just kind of doing odd jobs. But very soon afterward, the editor-in-chief left under slightly disputed and mysterious circumstances, and Stan became the editor-in-chief. Now, he was like 19 years old
Wow.
when this is happening. and comics are a huge business at this point. I mean, this is what all the kids, it was the, you know, smartphone of its day. It was this this medium that people really gravitated toward, especially kids. And he stayed in that editor-in-chief gig while also writing comics for about 20 years before anything interesting happened. Like, he was one of the all-time great second acts in American life. The Fantastic Four, which was his first big hit, along with writer-artist Jack Kirby, that doesn't come out until 1961. He's 38 at that point. So, you know, it's funny, Stan died yesterday, and today the Forbes 30 Under 30 came out, and I couldn't help but think, like, Stan is living proof that if you don't make it to the 30 Under 30, it's not necessarily a sign that you're not going to go on to great things.
Let's take a couple of calls. We've got Patrick in Babylon. He's on line one. Hi, Patrick.
Good afternoon.
So what do you want to add to the conversation, sir?
Well, everybody likes to quote Uncle Ben's line to Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility. But more emblematic of Spider-Man for me has always been situation in, I believe it was the Centennial issue number 100, and Spider-Man is fighting the Kingpin, and the Kingpin rains down blows on him and says, "You've always been a loser." And then Spider-Man is down, but he's not out, and he stands up, starts swinging his fist, and says, "I may have been a loser, but I've never been a quitter, and I won't start now."
Yeah.
So it's just, I'm sure there's people out there who will call in and cite not only the issue, but the pain, the page, and the panel.
But, in comics, obsessives? You're blowing my mind here.
But that's something I've always remembered. It's gotten me through a lot of rough times, like the bar exam. So that's something I always took with me. That's something I'll always thank Stan Lee for. And I was very glad I met him at Icon Science Fiction Festival out at the University of Stony Brook. And I told him I got to do independent studies writing a dramatic version of Paradise Lost, and the reason that the chairman of the department let me was because I could stand the middle, I could understand the Middle English used in John Milton's poem, and that was because I'd been reading The Mighty Thor.
Yeah, Thor always speak in this sort of faux Shakespearean Middle Englishy type thing. That's really remarkable.
Patrick, great call. Thank you so much.
Patrick.
Thank you, and Stan Lee, Excelsior, rest in peace, sleep well, you did good.
Indeed.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 212-433-9692. Have you have any favorite comic? Do you have anything you want to add about Stan Lee, why he was important, what a work he did, how it was important in your life? Let's go to, is it Louis in New Haven?
Hi, good afternoon. This is Louis in New Haven.
Hi, Louis. What would you like to add?
Well, I am admittedly not a huge comic book geek. However, my husband, Nathan, is very much a huge comic book geek, and he's a huge fan of all aspects of the Marvel Universe. And he and I were talking recently about the development of the line of X-Men characters and the concept that the X-Men were a bit of Stan Lee's level of social protest and trying to give a vision to the civil rights movement by having characters that were discriminated against based on their abilities or their differences. And so I wanted to bring that into the conversation. I wasn't sure if that was something that's more urban myth or if there's some significance to that.
It's a little, I mean, the trouble with every character that Stan co-created with his collaborators is their origin stories, their real-life origin stories, are always a bit murky. Neither Stan nor his most important collaborators, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, kept really extensive records, so there isn't a whole lot of hard evidence saying who came up with what or what the inspiration for one thing was. So he certainly later in life would talk about being opposed to bigotry and prejudice, but it's unclear the degree to which the X-Men was really intended to be that. It certainly stands as a text that can be read that way, though.
We're speaking with Abraham Reisman, staff writer at New York Magazine and Vulture, who wrote the 2016 profile of Stan Lee's legacy called It's Stan Lee's Universe. Patrick brought up Spider-Man.
Yes.
And the beginnings of Spider-Man. Can you explain why that comic was so different at the time?
Well, one of the things was it was about a teenager who wasn't a sidekick. This was a rarity back then. Usually your superheroes were, you know, lantern-jawed, chiseled adults, and teenagers were like Robin or Bucky, you know, these tag-alongs. And Stan and his co-creator of Spider-Man, Steve Ditko, came up with this idea for the character, and Stan really wanted him to be a teen so that teens could relate to him. And the other thing that you have to remember is, as of the early 1960s when this is happening, you have this generation of kids who were reading real kiddie comics when they were very young, and Stan was very successful at drawing them back into comics by saying, hey, now we've got stuff that can appeal to you as an adolescent. And so seeing this character, Peter Parker, who has remarkable abilities but really struggles to keep his life together, is something that pretty much anyone who's going through puberty and high school can relate to. And even though a lot of those early stories read a little thin today, they were revolutionary at the time, and more importantly, they set out a concept and template that people have been able to play with ever since then. And yeah, it's a testament to the resilience of these ideas.
We've got two great callers. John from Fanwood, New Jersey.
Thank you.
Hey, so your dad knew Stan Lee?
What?
Yeah. My father was a comic book and comic strip artist after World War II and into the 70s and 80s.
Sorry, who was he? Who was your father?
John Solardo.
Okay.
He never had his own strip. He did Tarzan for 15 years. But the coolest thing was he was a good friend of Stan Lee's. And Stan used to send Christmas gifts to all his buddies. And he always wrapped them in a Spider-Man poster that he signed.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I have two of them.
Excellent, John. Thanks for sharing the story.
Thanks, John.
Let's go to Richard in the Bronx. So, Richard, you're a huge fan.
Yeah, I came up from Jamaica, West Indies, when I was 8 or 9 years old. Really kind of alone and really didn't understand much about the culture. And it was through Marvel Comics and Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer, Spider-Man, that I really gained a sense of facility in America. I mean, I know it sounds very grand and weird, but
no, not weird at all.
Absolutely transformed how I speak even to this day. I collected so many comics that my sons and I have been trying to get them to read more comics. So I have thousands of some of the original comics that I'll be turning over to my sons, but I refuse to give them up now while I'm still alive. They're comics, I love them, but when I pass on, then I'll give it to my sons. But it's really, I cannot overestimate how, in my opinion, my life, Marvel Comics and Stan Lee and Jack Kirby really were transformational in terms of how important the I collected comics through teenagehood. When I got married, I was still collecting comics. I probably stopped, I'm 50 now, I probably stopped only about 10 or 12 years ago just because I got too busy with the kids.
Dang.
Richard, thank you so much.
Thanks,
for
Richard.
Your call. That was fantastic. His collaboration with Kirby, can you let people know, because that's come up a couple times?
Yeah, so Jack Kirby was a writer-artist. He died in 1994. Arguably the greatest creator that superhero comics has ever seen. He was a tremendous visual stylist and designer. He was a writer as well, and there are people who defend his writing. There are people who deride it. It's a little more controversial, but in terms of his art, unassailable. And he and Stan had a very difficult relationship. I'll try to be as brief as I can, but
about a minute and a half.
Okay, minute and a half. Great. Let's see here. So they had a method of creating the comics where Stan and Jack would come up with a plot a very basic plot, then Jack would go and draw the entire issue and essentially come up with the story and how it would play out, then bring it back to Stan, and Stan would put in the dialogue and the narration. Now, the trouble with this is that means Jack was essentially a co-writer. He was writing the story and helping come up with the plot in the first place. But Stan always billed himself as the writer and billed Jack as the artist. And that was something that really hurt Jack. And that and various other slights led to Jack really saying some very mean things about Stan late in his life. Yeah, it was tough.
So are you surprised at how much these calls mean to people?
Not in the slightest, no. These are very important pieces of intellectual property in people's lives.
Abraham Reisman is staff writer at New York Magazine and Vulture. You should read his 2016 profile of Stan Lee. Abraham, thank you so much for joining us on All of It today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon. You can follow All of It on our Instagram. There are great pictures there. All of It WNYC. Also at Twitter, at All of It WNYC. See you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.